You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
His given name was Charles-Édouard Jeanneret, but the world knew him as Le Corbusier, and most architects and architecture students called him affectionately Corbu. While much is known about him as a pioneer of modern architectural design, very little has been written about Le Corbusier's personal life. Nicholas Fox Weber has reviewed hundreds of previously unpublished letters and created a portrait that's fuller and longer than anything published until now. His book, Le Corbusier, A Life, is just out from Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nicholas Fox Weber back to the show today. Hi.
Hi.
I've seen your book described as epic. It contains more than 820 pages. Is that because Le Corbusier has become a figure of mythic proportions?
It's because it's such a rich life, and so little was known about it. And I was given the very rare privilege of being allowed to quote anything that he had written, blanket permission, and I had a wonderful translator, Richard Howard, who dealt with Corbu's very idiomatic and often obscene French, and translated it perfectly into English. And a lot of the book depends on that source material.
But you also got access to other letters and to other people's diaries.
Yes, I did. Letters written by his mother, diaries of Josephine Baker, who was one of his lovers, letters written to him by a Connecticut divorcee with whom he had a great love affair. This helped me greatly.
And when you began, did you have any idea that you would end up with such an exhaustive study of Le Corbusier?
I didn't know what I would end up with. The truth is that it was a very rough beginning. Starting that book is the way I imagine it would be to arrive at a Swiss bank and try to get into a vault. I met up with an iron door, in effect, and I felt very fortunate after becoming discouraged by the secondary material to get into the letters and discover a fascinating human being.
Now, you'd written a biography of Balthus, a painter. But,
yes.
Did you have any interest in modern architecture or architectural history before you began this?
Very much so. I went to Yale Graduate School and studied architectural history there. I worked with Vincent Scully on my master's degree and went to Ronchamp in the early 70s. I had a great love for Le Corbusier's work going back a long time.
Well, he was the king for a while. Is he as highly regarded today as he was in the late 50s, early 60s?
Quite the opposite, or I should say he's regarded in very different ways. There are some people to whom he's the great hero and the most beautiful architect, but he's totally vilified by others. And in France in the past couple of years, there have been times when urban violence has been attributed to his design.
Because he created these huge buildings that, well, the equivalent of housing projects, even if they were fancier than the stripped-down housing projects we're used to in this city.
That's correct. And some of the worst housing projects are blamed on him, even though they're really not his fault.
So when Jane Jacobs and others started criticizing that kind of thinking, Le Corbusier became their target?
Very much so.
Perhaps hundreds of books have already been written about Le Corbusier and his work, and he wrote some 50 books about his theories. Were you concerned that we knew everything that we needed to know about the man?
Well, I felt that we knew very little about the man, in fact. When I began the book about 9 years ago, I asked a number of people I knew, including some very savvy architects and people who knew a lot about modern art, do you know if Le Corbusier was married? And people didn't even know that. Now, when we think of Picasso, we're very aware of the women in his life. And most people educated in a certain way know that Matisse had a very important wife. But people had no idea about Le Corbusier's private life.
Even though he sometimes went under the name Jeanneret, she was always Yvonne Le Corbusier.
Yes.
And yet she hated architecture.
She had no interest whatsoever in architecture. It was forbidden as a topic at the dinner table. She mainly liked to gossip and tell dirty jokes.
And he says he liked to talk dirty, too. Then maybe that's the reason they were attracted to each other.
Well, there was a lot about Von Von, as he called Yvonne, that appealed to him immensely. They had a stormy marriage, but one that he called the linchpin of his life.
On the other hand, as you point out, he had mistresses all along.
Yes, he did.
She have lovers?
Not that I know of.
What about his personality? He is remembered by many as a cold-hearted megalomaniac.
You know,
and somebody who's really arrogant.
I was interviewed a couple weeks ago, and someone said to me, "So Le Corbusier had no moral compass," and this was a comment based on his having been having attempted to work with the government of Vichy France, which I find utterly reprehensible. But on the issue of a moral compass, I'm very aware that shortly after I began the research, I heard a story about Le Corbusier being taken to the studio of an impoverished painter. And on his way out, Le Corbusier left a great deal of cash behind in such a way that the painter would never know who it came from. And there are a number of stories of this sort. A young architect who worked in his office, who just after the war didn't have enough money for a meal and went home to a Paris flat with a new baby. And the night that he went home with the new baby, it was New Year's Eve, and the guardian of his building said that someone had arrived with a hamper full of foie gras and caviar and luxuries beyond his imagining. And the young architect said, "Well, who would deliver on New Year's Eve?" And the guardian replied, "A man with round eyeglasses and a bow tie."
And that immediately brought to mind Le Corbusier.
Yes, that was one of his trademark.
Do you think it was a starkness and austerity of much of his architecture that contributed to that reputation for being an unfeeling person?
Well, I think he had a very cruel side in person. There was a young architect who wanted more credit for a building, and Le Corbusier gave him the impression that they had resolved their differences over it. And when the young architect returned after his August vacation, he discovered that Corbu had changed the locks on the door. He became incredibly nasty to people he disliked. And he certainly had it in for Americans in general.
Why was that? He had a long-held grudge against Americans.
It began with great optimism. In 1935, he came to this country for the first time, and he thought that it was here that he would really build, that he would realize his dreams. And then he was attacked almost instantly because shortly after arriving here, he remarked that New York's skyscrapers were not tall enough. And what he meant by
this— They were the tallest in the world at the time.
They were, but not as tall as he imagined a skyscraper could be. And he felt that the buildings here were too close to each other so that people didn't have great views. And that had they been taller, they could have been spaced further apart.
And his concept of the ideal city would have been very tall buildings and a lot of grass in between.
That's correct.
Parks.
A great deal of greenery and recreation space and room for sports in between the buildings. But then to answer your question about what happened with America, not only did he fail to get the client base he was hoping for in 1935, but after the war, when he returned here, he thought that he would be designing the United Nations building. And ultimately, the building was not his design, but he felt that it took his design, stole it, and did a bad job with it.
Well, there were other foreign architects who did quite well in this country, Walter Gropius, for example, and Mies van der Rohe. So it wasn't American hostility to foreign architects, was it that Le Corbusier's ideas didn't work as well here as they did in some other parts of the world?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, the other two architects you named both moved here, and it was only after they moved here that Mies and Gropius really got a lot of work here. Le Corbusier would never have lived anywhere but Paris.
Even though he was Swiss.
He hated being Swiss, though. He was very definite about that, and he became a French citizen when he married Yvonne. And he just did not get the commissions here, in part because he was so prickly.
My guest is Nicholas Fox Weber. His latest book, Le Corbusier, A Life, is published by Knopf. He was a painter first. Was he good enough painter to have made it as a painter?
Another very good question. I don't think he would have made it as a painter. He started out as a young man trying to follow his father's path as an enameler of watch cases. When that proved very taxing for him and he had eye problems, I could only see with one eye. He did try painting in every form of design. He was determined only to be a painter, couldn't make a go of it. Then he was determined to be a businessman and build bricks and have factories. And again, he did not make a go of it.
He and a friend, Amédée Ozenfant, started an art journal and also an art movement called Purism, which was kind of like an offshoot of Cubism. I'm not sure whether it was closer to Picasso's synthetic cubism or to Juan Gris' approach, but it does look kind of sterile, but it also looks a bit architectural.
It's very architectural, and on the other hand, the architecture can be very pictorial. So many people feel that the use of color and rhythm in the architecture very much reflects the eye of a painter.
When did he become Le Corbusier instead of Charles-Édouard Jeanneret?
He became Le Corbusier with Ozenfant, which is to say they both took new names, when they began to publish the magazine L'Esprit Nouveau, The New Spirit, in the early 1920s. And Le Corbusier wanted to differentiate himself as a painter from himself as an architect. And there are many sources of the name. He always said that it was based on an ancestor with the name of Le Corbusier. But I feel that the great influence was that he was obsessed with a biography he had read by Ernst Rehan of Jesus Christ. And he considered himself a martyr in the tradition of Christ. He took his copy of that book and wrote notes throughout the margins and underlined passages. And in effect, he became another Le Si. In French, it's Le Christus. And he became Le Si. It was very convenient that his mother's name was already Mary or Marie. And at the same time as Le Corbusier, he became a force. That name sounds like someone who encircles people.
So what do people call him? Did they call him Edouard? Did they call him Corbu?
Well, they called him various things, and he called himself various things. So when he wrote to his mother, as he did all the time, he would write in the first person or the third person. He would refer to himself as I, but also as Le Corbusier or Edouard. The family called him Edouard. His parents simply called him Ed. And most of the world called him Corbu.
And he wrote letters we mentioned earlier. Wrote a lot to his mother, but those are not the ones that most people are really fascinated by. It's the ones he wrote to someone like William Ritter, a Swiss music critic who was his mentor, to his wife, to his American mistress, where there was an awful lot of discussion of his sex life and sexual fantasies. I don't know what that has to do with him being an architect, but it's there constantly.
Well, you know, if I quote him, I want to make it very clear it's not something I'm saying, but that he said. But he did use to say that the word erection, which is the same in French as in English, could refer to very personal experience or could refer to one of his buildings.
Let's talk a bit about the philosophy of building here, because we've been talking about everything but what he did.
Yes.
Why was he considered such an important architect during his lifetime?
Well, because he did utterly extraordinary buildings that weren't like anyone else's. If you look at the studio he did for Amédée Ozenfant in 1922, it has angles and light that had never been imagined in architecture. He did a house for his parents at the side of Lake Geneva, where it's as if the sun and the sea entered this modest and beautiful space.
Although he bankrupted his parents as a result.
He bankrupted them with an earlier house, and I feel that for the rest of his life he was embarrassed over having gone through their fortune when he tried to house them in a very grand way.
He built huge complexes, and is even planned to have streets within the complexes, of one big building with all sorts of stuff inside.
Yes.
Is he responsible for things like Battery Park City?
I'd say that many people could trace Battery Park City and Co-op City to ideas of Le Corbusier's, but his great apartment building, built just after World War II in Marseille, had in it public spaces, a school on the roof, a playground. It's just one very lively building. There was a kindergarten. There was a hotel so that people could have their guests stay there. And this was low-income housing, which is very important to remember. He was not a builder for the rich. One of his greatest buildings was the Salvation Army building, which he built in Paris in the early 30s, and gave great glory to the lives of homeless people.
How many of his buildings have survived?
There's an excellent book called A Le Corbusier Guide, and it's not such a big book. I don't want to give a precise number, but I would say roughly 30.
Out of how many?
Oh, he would do 25 or 30 building plans a year that never got built. It's not that many buildings have been destroyed. It's that a number simply were not built.
When you knew them first, I'm sure, from photographs, how different were they when you actually saw them in person?
Leonard, there was nothing to equal the experience of seeing the buildings in India in person. I know it's a very hard thing for people to do, and in my writing, I hope that I've allowed people to imagine what it is like to enter those spaces. The assembly building at Champ de Gare, you walk in and you feel as if you've entered a forest glade. It's very quiet, as if you could be surrounded by trees. And then you walk into an auditorium, which is an architectural experience that I found so unbelievable that I really did wonder at first if it was a sort of dream. No photograph prepared me. It's the way it might be being like if one could be inside a greatly enlarged human heart.
So he's fallen out of favor these days, and your suggestion might be that we reevaluate once again?
Oh, I think we certainly should reevaluate, and the way to do it is to look at the utterly sensational buildings.
He died in a drowning accident in 1965. He was in his 70s at the time, wasn't
he? Yes, he was.
It's been rumored that he didn't really drown accidentally, that he was committing suicide.
When I began work on the book, I spent a lot of time talking with his doctor, Jacques Hindermeyer, who's still alive, who's now in his mid-80s. And Dr. Hindermeyer was very clear in telling me that he had advised Le Corbusier to limit his swimming that summer, and Le Corbusier absolutely promised him that he would only swim in the afternoons. He drowned at 9:30 in the morning, having been swimming for at least an hour. Not only did he violate the doctor's orders, but I learned from a young architect who had been living next to Le Corbusier on the coast of France at the time, that the day before he drowned, he asked this young architect to take some important documents back to Paris. And the architect replied, "But Corbu, you're going back to Paris before I am. You always go back on the 1st of September. And you know, I'm going to Venice, and then I'll be in Paris after you." And Le Corbusier absolutely insisted that this man take them, as if he was sure that he would not be returning to Paris.
Nicholas Fox Weber is the director of the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation, the author of 13 previous books, and now Le Corbusier, A Life, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Nicholas Fox Weber will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6:30. That's at Urban Center Books at 457 Madison Avenue. More information is on our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Daniel Liebskind, one of today's leading architects, talks about how philosophy, film, and music have influenced his life and work. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.